May. May's dad gives her a lift to Kuala Lumpur Airport. "You know, this is a great plan," he says. "This is the sort of plan I'd have made way back when." May's dad thinks that May is going to London to meet some friends for a weekend of partying, a trip which is to be kept secret from her mum. May couldn't tell him the truth, that she's chasing a memory trace to an unknown city, alone. He wouldn't have understood. Every now and again, May's mum and dad call an uneasy truce in order to share information about how well, or not, May is doing. And the truth is exactly the sort of thing that could bring about a truce. But a clandestine weekend of getting fucked up in the very city her mum lives in without her mum's knowledge? May's dad is delighted at the thought. "This is what you need, darling," he says. "Your mum worries about you, but that's no way to live. That's why you came to stay with me, right? I mean, she's always been overprotective. No wonder you ended up depressed. All that at uni. She didn't get that this is the sort of thing you ought to be doing. Getting out there, drinking, having fun." "Absolutely," says May. Her dad had always been confused by the hows and whys of May failing her second year exams. It wasn't the kind of failure he understood. May didn't fail because of recreational drugs. She failed because of study drugs. Modafinil in the day, Xanax to sleep at night. May could tell at the time that he thought the real problem was that she was doing the wrong drugs. "Good, clean fun," that's what his smile says now. Meanwhile, May's wondering how wise it was to be taking advice from a disembodied voice about bold moves. "Almost as soon as you've made one, it doesn't feel bold anymore." She's not sure the voice was right, because the move isn't feeling less bold, it's feeling more bold, nearly unbearably bold. She stares out of the window, trying to reel her anxiety back in. "Here we are," her dad announces redundantly when they get to the airport. He helps her with her case, darts in, exuberant, almost shy, for a kiss on the cheek. May almost holds on to him then, wanting to cry out, "I lied. I'm scared. I don't know what I'm doing. Take me home." She takes a long breath and the feeling passes. "Have a blast, darling," her dad says. "And mum's the word, right? Ah, literally." The airport is very new and very sleek. A curving false ceiling, like an idea of a bird's belly, is held up by curving pillars, like the idea of trees. Above that, there's glass, behind which is real forest, or what May thinks is real forest. Maybe it's a holographic forest. May gets herself a flat white and a pastry, tries to regulate her breathing, which has been short and panicked since she watched her case disappear down the conveyor belt, and gets down to business. Business being going through Katya's and Sophia's social media feeds. When May left uni, her mum had encouraged her to cut ties, real and digital, with both girls. From a purely Pavlovian point of view, they were a bad thing, she said. She'd already got May to tell her that Sophia had been the one who sorted out the drugs for them all. Though, in Sophia's defense, she did warn that modafinil was called that because it was just for finals, and later she said that she thought May was using the Xanax for coke comedowns, not to, like, get dependent on. None of it was really May's friend's fault. May had been feeling sad and unmotivated before she got behind with work. She can't remember why she'd been feeling that way, which she guesses is the fault of the wipe. Then, when she realized she'd got properly, irreversibly behind, she started to panic. She decided she'd get a little extra bit of chemical help to get back on top again. And then it was only a couple of months before the drugs made her feel genuinely insane, and she started crying in the library and couldn't stop, and that's when they called her mum. May had deleted all her past chats with Sophia and Katya on various apps, untagged herself from their photos, and removed them as friends on others. Standard practice, according to May's mum's guide to ending unhealthy relationships. Standard practice, May now thinks, before a memory wipe. Anyway, she was worried that she wouldn't be able to find out any information about their trip at all. But, thank God, and, of course, both Sophia's and Katya's feeds are public. May scrolls through the last couple of years until, just next to a video of Katya twerking on a loop in cut-off denim shorts, she spots the first canal boat. None of the hashtags are enlightening, but in the next picture, there are three beers sitting together on a sunlit upturned barrel, the name of the bar, Café Belgique, clearly visible in the background. In another picture, there's a latte with a heart drawn on it and a napkin next to it with the name of the coffee house, Armand's Coffee. There's Sophia eating a hash brownie in a large bar with purple lighting. There are Katya and Sophia on bicycles next to a sign saying Vondelpark. May isn't in any of the pictures, but that's not so strange. She probably got deleted after they fell out. May favourites all the identifiable places in her phone's map app and makes a note to look for the others. She's already tried Googling Amsterdam canal houses, tall houses, Dutch canal side, red house, orange house, and so on. But she can't find the ones from her memory trace. She's hoping that she might just pass them by chance as she walks from one favorited place to the next. She's frightened that she won't pass them. She's frightened that she will. May's mum once told her about some study to do with rats. May can't remember what the study was, but she remembers her mum saying that at some point the rats became depressed. Wait, how did they know the rats were depressed? Asked May. There's a simple test, her mum said. The float test. They put the rats in water. A happy rat will swim to survive. A depressed rat just floats. Oh, said May. A couple of months ago, her mother's story came back to May. She'd been living at home for a few months by then, though the day she'd packed her things and left university seemed like a long time ago. She wasn't going out, though she told her mum she went for walks each day. She held books and pretended to be reading them as she stared out of the window. She looked at celebrity gossip pages online and told her mum she was looking up university syllabuses. She sat at the dinner table and asked questions about current affairs and pretended she was interested in the answers. Then one day she thought, I'm a floating rat. So she stopped taking her antidepressants. This had mixed results in that she felt sharper, more feeling, but she also found it harder to be around her mum. The feelings May's mum provoked were mixed. So May went to Kuala Lumpur, and now she's in the middle of the mixed results of that. And where is May now? She considers it. She definitely feels more, which is a good thing. She's also telling a lot of lies, and she's anxious a lot of the time. But on the plus side, she thinks, I'm swimming. May arrives in Amsterdam at night She doesn't have the energy to find the right tram, so she gets a cab as far as it can take her, a couple of streets away from her hotel, and walks the rest of the way, dragging her case over the cobbles. Once she's in her room, she stands and looks out of the window at the busy street and canal below. She's taken a lot of flights in her life. She knows that she's tired. She ought to go to bed. But all she feels is a peppery, agitated wakefulness. Get moving, it urges. Let's get started. May takes a taxi to the first of the destinations on her list, the purple-lit bar. She'd managed to Google image search it and find out its name, Neuhaus, off the Amstelstraat. But as soon as she gets there, she finds she's exhausted. She sits on a shiny banquette with a beer, recognizing nothing. Then, after about an hour, walks back to her hotel. There's a group of people about May's own age in the lobby. They're gathered around a boy who's lying on one of the sofas. May can just see his arms waving above the cushions. "I can't do it! I can't go on!" he's saying in a loud voice. May slows down, alarmed. But as she gets closer, it becomes apparent that the group is laughing. The boy is laughing. Two girls take a hand each and start trying to lever him up from the sofa. When they give up, one of the girls turns, still laughing, and catches May's eye. She smiles at May. May, embarrassed at having been caught watching them, looks away. It's only a half second before she realizes she ought to have smiled back, but by that time the girl has turned away again. May goes upstairs. She shuts the door of her room and feels, suddenly, like crying. "I'm tired," she thinks. "That's all." She sits on the bed and pulls the duvet and blankets in around herself until she's cocooned like a pupa. She used to wrap herself up like that when she was very young, she remembers. It's comforting to do it now. She thinks, "I'm not just tired." Well, she is, but she's also piercingly miserable. She's lonely. But she's going to do something about that. She's going to find out what's wrong with her, what happened to her, and then she's going to take part in things and be happy and have friends and roll around with them on sofas and laugh. And furthermore, sleep. May wakes up early the next morning. It's a sunny day, so she walks to the second place on her list, Armand's Coffee. She orders a flat white, sits in a corner, and looks around. It's a single room with a worn parquet floor, white walls, and a collection of lights hung at different heights over the tables. There's a fiddle leaf fig in the corner and a counter with pastries on top of it. Behind the counter is a girl in a coffee-stained apron. Across the room, there's a guy working on a laptop, wearing headphones. There's a woman at the counter, deciding on a cake. So far, so nothing. May isn't sure what she was expecting. She didn't remember the hotel, the bar last night, and now she doesn't remember this coffee shop. She knows she's been here, but she has no memory of it. The sensation is strange. It's the opposite of haunting. She feels disturbingly unhaunted. Disappointment rises, then frustration at herself for expecting the impossible. Stupid, she thinks. She already knew that revisiting the scene or object of a deleted memory couldn't bring back the memory itself. It always used to annoy her mum when it happened in films. Some character would have something deleted at a Nepenthe-esque clinic, then come out and see the person they were trying to forget, and it would all come flooding back. "Preposterous," said May's mum. So May should have known better. She'd just thought she knew better still, that maybe she'd be the exception. when the only thing she's ever been exceptional at is getting things wrong. May realizes that the girl across the counter is looking at her. She wonders what she's been doing with her face, screwing it up, probably. She makes an effort to look smoother. "Do you want something else?" the girl says. "Because I'm going to have a break and call my mother, and I want to make sure I won't be interrupted by customers ordering things while I'm doing that." "Oh," May says, taken aback. "I'll have another coffee." She hesitates. "If that's okay?" "I can do that," the girl says, with a magnanimous wave of her hand. Then she pauses and looks at May more closely. "You've been in here before?" she says. "I'm not sure," May says. She feels a tremor of something, a twitch, the kind of excitement detectives and journalists are always experiencing. This could be it, she thinks. A lead. "I have, I think." The girl nods. She turns away and starts making May's coffee. "But you remember me being here?" May asks. She wants to lean over the counter and get hold of the girl's uninterested shoulders. "Who I was with? What was I doing?" "I don't know," says the girl. "You should know these things." "I have memory problems," May says. "You were probably stoned," says the girl. "You tourists always get too stoned." May gives up. "Okay," she says. "Thanks." Feeling disappointed, she takes her coffee and sits down. The girl picks up a pan au chocolat and takes a seat at one of the tables outside. She starts talking on her phone. May puts some money down on the counter and walks out of the cafe. She tries to catch the girl's eye as she passes so she can smile and point at the money she left, but the girl is talking loudly in Dutch and doesn't notice her go. It doesn't take May long to visit the other places on her list. It's not like she, Katya, and Sophia roamed very far. She spends a day walking around the city. She hasn't walked for a while and quickly gets a blister. She goes to the Belgian cafe with the beer barrel tables outside and orders a beer. The cafe is canal side, but the houses opposite it are wrong. May's seen so many gabled houses now that she's made a little sketch of the ones in her original memory in case they get overwritten. She knows that's something that can happen. By the end of the day, she's in the last of her destinations, the Vondelpark. It's very pretty, with the late afternoon sun coming through the trees that her phone tells her are birch, plane, red chestnut. People cycle along the wide paths through the patches of sunlight. The Vondelpark reminds May of various other parks she's been to. It does not remind her of itself at all. What now, she wonders. But she already knows. There's nothing now. May walks back to her hotel as evening falls. A feeling jolts her as she walks. Anger. She's angry at herself. May's mum always says that being angry with herself is pointless and damaging, but in this case, it seems appropriate. There's a part of May that May wasn't previously aware of, and this part of herself has made the decision to erase some of May's memory, and it won't explain why. May is chasing this partial self, and it's running away. And yes, it might be pointless and damaging, but May still wants to get hold of that treacherous partial self, wrestle it to the ground, twist its arm, and not let go until it gives up all its secrets. The really frustrating thing is that Nepenthe could actually give May her memory back if it wanted to. There's been an ongoing court case, and at the end of it, Nepenthe might be ordered to give everyone their memory back. But the case has been going on for so long, it could go on for months or years more, according to May's mum. May realizes how tired she is when she sees her bed. The adrenaline of the hunt has staved off the jet lag, but that was never going to last forever. Now she feels like she's been shot with a tranquilizer dart. The anger she felt earlier is gone, submerged. She remembers she was supposed to email her mum and sends her a brief, bright email about how she's tried a couple of new restaurants in Kuala Lumpur and is reading a good book. She lies down on the bed, on her back, and texts her dad for good measure, an emoji of a martini glass. He texts back an emoji of a thumbs up. She drops the phone on her face. "Ow," she says. Then she must fall asleep, because it's light suddenly, and she's lying in bed with the phone next to her, ringing. It's her mum. May lets it go to voicemail, then listens to it. "Hi, Plum," says May's mum. "I got your email. You sounded odd. A little too determinedly upbeat, perhaps. Is everything okay? Call me." May winces. She doesn't want to talk to her mum. May's heard of insurance companies installing lie-detecting voice software on their phone lines to tell if customers are making fraudulent claims. May's mother is like the human version of that. But then, May can also tell when her mum is lying. For example, her mum said that she liked May's chess club friends, but also she thought May would enjoy spending time with different people too. Her mum said May was capable of dealing with her own problems, but also May should probably take some antidepressants. She said that May could make her own choices, but also, given May's history and May's challenges, May might need extra help and support, and, oh, those are May's choices, in which case May might want to give them some more thought, especially in light of the choices she's made so far. May's mum didn't say that last bit exactly, but May knew. Aside from anything else, May's fundamental patheticness, issues, says her mum. Her utter stupidity, faulty reasoning, says her mum. And the epic failure, learning process, says her mum, that was her university career, speak for themselves. And now she's in Amsterdam, realizing that maybe she hasn't made a bold move. Just a stupid one. Maybe it's another consequence of coming off her meds so abruptly. Maybe she's not rational. May realizes she's wrapped herself in the duvet again. She's wound it too tight this time. She's feeling hot and slightly panicked. Her breathing is short and fast, reminding her of a rabbit she held once at a petting zoo. Is she going straight from floating rat to frightened rabbit? She struggles free and gets out of bed. She takes off her clothes from the day before, showers, and gets dressed again. She refocuses. She has one more full day in Amsterdam, plenty of time for investigating. The problem is, she's not sure where to start. In the absence of a plan, she goes back to the coffee shop, Armand's. She liked it in there. The young woman from before isn't working today, which is a relief. May sits in the window and texts her mum, a slightly less upbeat message. She hopes that'll give her a little more time. "I told you," says a man's voice. "There's a whole box of oranges downstairs. That should be enough." May's hand is holding her cup halfway to her mouth when she hears this. The cup halts and tips. A splash of coffee hits the table. The man who is talking has just come into the room from a door leading to some stairs. He has his back to May and is speaking to the younger guy behind the counter. He has curly dark hair and wide shoulders. She can't see his profile. For a moment she stares at him, incapable of moving. Is she even breathing? No, she is not. Fear has switched her off. She tries to breathe, succeeds, inhales too much, almost coughs. But now her arms and legs are back, thank God, and she can slide out of her seat, gather up her stuff as quietly and quickly as she can. She turns her face away from the man, towards the door, not looking up, or back, not even once she's out in the street again and safe. There's a whole box of oranges downstairs. Bold moves aren't such a big deal. It's the same voice. She doesn't have to think about it, she knows. A European accent, mid-pitched. The tone is the same, friendly, relaxed about both oranges and bold moves. It doesn't relax May. It agitates her. The agitation disturbs her because she doesn't understand it. She isn't sure if it's excitement or dread that stirs her stomach up, if it's longing or fright that jolts her. May hadn't actually thought what would happen if she found the owner of the voice, but now she has, and she has no idea what she's going to do about it. Introducing herself is out of the question. She needs more information for her own protection. Better, she decides, to follow the man for a little while. Find out where he lives, who he is, why she might have been talking to him. Why she didn't want to remember anything about him. She spends her afternoon sitting at a bar across the road from Armand's, watching the man in the cafe. She sips a beer slowly and writes things down in her phone. Seems to be owner or manager. Nice to customers. He jokes with people when he carries their drinks out to the small tables in the sun. The customers laugh back. Dark curly hair, needs trim. Tan. Long eyelashes. Hot. Something the customers also seem to notice. At least one woman watches him through the glass. Others flirt with him. The man doesn't pay them any particular attention. When they leave, he doesn't watch them go. In a relationship? Writes May. After the cafe closes, the man goes back to his flat. May pays her bill in a hurry and follows him, walking on the other side of the street. It's a 10-minute walk, and he walks quickly, going finally into a tall old house divided into flats. May stops short, slightly out of breath. They're on the Prinzengracht, the canal of princes. She hasn't walked along this part of it before. She turns and looks up. Above her, there is a row of townhouses. One is red. One is orange. May stands on the pavement and gazes at them, standing against the blueness of the sky. Underneath the houses is a small Surinamese restaurant, just opening up for the evening. She goes in and asks for the table in the window. She spends the evening ordering dish after dish, eating slowly, all the time watching. May's feeling a bit uneasy about that by now. It's one thing sitting at a cafe with a glass of beer opposite a coffee house and watching what goes on inside. The cafe is technically public space, but it's another thing sitting opposite a man's apartment, watching him move around his own home. It's true that he has no curtains, or he's left them open and the lights are on, but that almost makes it worse, the openness. The man lets himself be watched because he assumes nobody would watch. It hasn't occurred to him that, like the prostitutes in their windows, he has an audience. Right now, the man seems to be watching TV. The screen is out of May's limited viewline, but she can see his head tilted upwards, unmoving. She writes, "Lives alone?" "Is there anything else?" the waiter asks her. He's looking at her dubiously because May's already ordered a snack, two courses, two cups of coffee, and an ice cream dessert she left unfinished. What else could there possibly be? She glances again at the flat opposite. The man seems to have gone to bed. The rooms are in darkness. It's 10:30, and she still doesn't know anything about him. She could cross the road, ring the bell for his apartment, wake him, talk to him, but the thought of it frightens her. To face him would be to face their inequality. May standing at the bottom of the mountain of this is what happened, the man at the top. She'd have to trust him to pull her up. She doesn't feel trust. She's getting quicker now at identifying her feelings. What are they? Worry. Fear. She won't face him. Which leaves her with what? Back to the hotel. To bed. Her flight is early tomorrow morning. When the staff unlock the door of Armand's coffee shop, water the flowers and put its tables and chairs out, May will be sitting in a departure lounge waiting to go home. Is there anything else? The problem with her plan is that it didn't have an anything else. I'll get the bill, please, she tells the waiter. He gives a small bow. Then he looks past her, towards the counter on the other side of the restaurant. Hello, Mr. Armand, he says. Take away? One moment, please. May looks up. The man is waiting at the counter with a menu in his hands. For the first time, he realizes that he's being looked at. He looks up, directly at May. He blinks. May? He says.